The following is rated not safe for work. It contains strong language, adult situations, and lots of spoilers. Discretion is advised.
In the criminal justice system, cinematic-based offenses are considered especially heinous. The dedicated attorneys who investigate these villainous films are members of an elite squad known as the Reels of Justice. These are their stories.
Order, please, order. The Reels of Justice is now in session. Judge Maynard Bangs presiding. We all eyes for the Honorable Judge Bangs.
Be seated. Welcome to the Reels of Justice. Today, we are hearing the case of The People versus Neighbors, a 1981 comedy film starring John Belushi as a suburban husband who has had his humdrum life disrupted when the house next door becomes occupied by a debaucherous woman and a rambunctious loudmouth. For those of you unfamiliar with our court proceedings, we are here to determine if this film is guilty of being a bad movie. As always in this courtroom, films are to be considered excellent until proven awful, and the burden of proof lies upon the prosecution to prove beyond a shadow of a reasonable doubt that this film is guilty. Mr. Ryan Born to Party, Luis Rodriguez, you are appearing on behalf of the prosecution. You may present your opening statement.
Well, first off, I'd like to say thank you for giving me a nickname that doesn't hurt my feelings for once.
Hey, all right.
All right. Every once in a while, along comes a film that makes us believe in the enthralling possibilities of cinema. A film so infectious in its joy and so perfectly calibrated that we must stand back in awe and give thanks to the Lord Almighty that something so miraculous was possible. A film starring two beloved comedians from Saturday Night Live, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, with unparalleled chemistry, doing what they do best, entertaining the masses with a time-tested dynamic that harkens back to the likes of Laurel and Hardy or Abbott and Costello. Two beloved comedians perfectly suited to the material written specifically for them, delivering everything we expect and hope for when we see their names on a theater marquee. And that film is The Blues Brothers. But yes, unfortunately, we're not here to discuss The Blues Brothers. We're here to discuss its polar opposite, Neighbors, a film so ill-conceived and misguided that one can only stand back and wonder in utter shock and disbelief. Who let them do this? And why? A nightmare of a film from which there is no escape. A dead zone of supposed comedy. An exercise in flaccid fecundity. Thank you. Case dismissed.
Flaccid fecundity. That used to be my nickname in college. Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez. Appearing on behalf of the defense is Mr. Marty Cotola. Please present your opening statement.
Hello. Now, I'm not here to pretend that this movie is good. I'm only here to make sure that this film is not accused of being bad. It is merely guilty of being odd. And it also completely makes you say, fuck expectations. We're gonna flip the characters around, which is a brave thing to do. And also, this movie has to play out the way it does. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Case dismissed. No, that's Ryan's line.
That's true. But you can't do it either.
Does anyone want to be here?
No.
Ben. Ben does.
I kind of want to be here.
Oh, very good. But
thank you, defense. Prosecution, you may proceed with your first exhibit.
Now, I'm glad the defense brought this up because let's first address the issue of casting and suitability. Now, legend has it that when Neighbors began production, Aykroyd was supposed to play Belushi's role and vice versa, and they switched parts so as to avoid being typecast, but in the process, smothered the film in its crib. John Belushi is not a put-upon everyman. He's a wrecking ball, a destructive force of nature. Aykroyd isn't an aggressor. He's an affable straight man with a propensity for technobabble. Are you seriously expecting me to believe that Bluto Blutarski tends to a garden? I also refuse to believe that someone with a hair trigger like Belushi would tolerate being taken advantage of for even a millisecond, he would immediately throttle Aykroyd at minute one. But beyond being miscast due to switching roles, regardless of who plays the lead, Aykroyd was 28 at the time of shooting, Belushi was 32. That means that Aykroyd would have been 8 when he sired a college-age daughter. Belushi would have been 12. You can slap dorky glasses on Belushi and artificially gray his temples, but sway me into believing he's age-appropriate, you cannot. And don't even get me started on Aykroyd's look. That distractingly absurd blonde hair and ungodly blue contact lenses that make him look like an alien in a fucking Marvel movie.
Yes. Defense, what do you have to say about these contact lenses?
Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to switch my exhibits around here a little bit. I'm going to make my exhibit 2 my exhibit 1. And so exhibit 1 will be Reels of Justice episode 46, The People versus Cable Guy, with Graham Skipper as the defense. He basically said that that movie was all about fuck expectations. It was, that was not the Jim Carrey they expected. Why, he was villainous and cruel. It, how dare he make a movie like this that was marketed the same way as his last 5 hit films and bait and switch me like this? That film was dismissed by people who didn't like Jim Carrey. But as the years went by, he went back and revisited the film and realized, oh, they did exactly what they were supposed to do. Flip the roles around. If Aykroyd had played the straight guy and Belushi had played the crazy guy, the movie probably would have been completely dull and forgettable because it would have been exactly what we expected. No, instead, they had the balls to flip it on its head. Now, whether or not that made for a great film, I don't think anybody's saying that, but it did certainly make for some definitely interesting moments, especially in the first hour of the film. I think the dark edge is what made it special.
Prosecution, this man has come into your house and thrown precedent in your face. What do you have to say?
Well, first of all, I was prosecuting that film, so I can't support what the jury concluded. But I'm not saying
I voted guilty.
I'm not saying that the problem with Neighbors is that I had the wrong expectations. I'm saying that they shouldn't have played those characters. It has nothing to do with what I believe Belushi and Aykroyd were capable of. I'm thinking what actually suits the movie. And by having them play the opposite types of characters, they're just simply not good at it, is my argument.
Question from the bench. Is the legend true? Did they really swap just a couple days before?
Not just a couple days before, but shortly before filming, which kind of threw everything into a tailspin.
Okay. If you'd like to proceed with your next argument?
Yes, I would. Thank you. Let's next address the issue of tone. Neighbors is ostensibly a black comedy, but it's more in theory than it is in execution. Director John G. Avildsen is best known for inspirational sports dramas like Rocky and The Karate Kid, and he's deficient in working in other types of genres. Black comedy requires a deft hand, one that can convince the audience to take a situation seriously until a joke or shock of unmistakable humor smacks them upside the head, creating a disconnect that puts the audience ill at ease. Avildsen unquestionably fails, and he isn't helped by the script. Now, Aykroyd's character could be effective if there was some element of subtle subtext, if anything he said could be alternately interpreted, with the audience sensing his sinister nature just below the surface. It would allow us to put ourselves in Belushi's shoes, like peering into the Matrix and sensing Aykroyd's nefarious source code. Instead, Aykroyd wears his antagonism on his sleeve. Just look at the edible panty scene, which I suppose is trying to be funny, but instead makes my skin crawl. When Aykroyd mentions Belushi tasting his daughter's cherry, there is no way to see that as an innocuous comment. It's an obvious instigation in a broadly comedic scene, a broadness that doesn't match the tone that they should be going for. The awkwardness isn't earned, which could be said for the entire film.
If we could only go 1 week on this show without talking about the edible panty scenes in every movie. Defense, do you have a rebuttal to these points?
Oh, yeah. Let's see here. This works out very well, actually. Oh, and of course he got punched in the face after making the panties line because he should have been punched in the face after that. So let me go to exhibit two here. We're going way back on this one. The Damn Dirty Drive-In, episode 200.
Featuring the KTMA years.
I was not part of the show. I will not be held responsible.
These do not count as precedent.
Not really, but Dan Aykroyd has a storied history with this podcast and probably will in the future. Way back on the third case ever, it was nothing but trouble.
Oh, boy.
Now, you remember that one. How can you forget that?
Yeah, I remember. We just put Nothing But Trouble on trial again last week.
And found it guilty.
Yes, we did.
So, Ron McAdams was the defense on that one. He did a pretty admirable job.
I love Ron McAdams.
Ron McAdams!
Ron McAdams!
Ron McAdams!
Say that on the pod, that's crazy. So, he did a pretty decent job trying to defend that movie, but that movie's indefensible. But when Dan Aykroyd makes something bad or weird or odd, it always has that kind of strangeness to it, right? And if Neighbors is truly guilty of anything, it's being coming from Dan Aykroyd's imagination and being stunted. All the movies that he tries to put out that are just bizarre always have some sort of production problems where the studio or the director or somebody won't let him do the vision that he wants to, and we get this kind of weird movie that comes out instead. My question is, has Aykroyd ever truly been unleashed outside of maybe the first Blues Brothers film? I don't know
if Ghostbusters.
We've seen it, but this is pretty close.
Oh, no.
I think he does an excellent job in this one being just untethered and bizarre. I mean, the weird blue contact lenses and the striking blonde hair. Watching this movie in HD for the first time was frightening, which goes back to Nothing But Trouble. That one, it was horror first, gross out second, and comedy third. This one almost kind of feels like it was horror first and comedy second, but as IMDb states, it was a comedy. But it's very much a black comedy. So that's my second exhibit there, that it's guilty of being Dan Aykroyd. Is that bad?
The prosecution, does Dan Aykroyd being Dan Aykroyd make up for the strange tone?
No, it absolutely does not. But here's the thing. Dan Aykroyd was not involved creatively in this project. He does not have a writing credit. He does not have a producing credit. He is there as an actor strictly. So to give the argument that Dan Aykroyd always does something weird and left field is a facetious argument.
Not all.
Because it's not his movie.
Well, he wanted
He's
to
a work. Part of it, yeah. But it's not his yeah. movie.
All right.
Defense? What were you going to reply to that?
Oh, during the whole legend of the production problems, from what I read, it sounded like he wanted to take over directing at one point. So he did want to have more of a creative control, even though he didn't write the book or the screenplay. But it's all legend.
Wait. Oh, Hollywood legend. Prosecution, you may continue with your next point.
Thank you. Done well, Neighbors could be an effective farce. But farce is a difficult balance to strike, which is why most attempts usually fail when they're trying to pull it off. Farce requires a gradual tightening of the noose, a slow clamping of the vise, before devolving into a maniacally paced door-slamming affair. But Neighbors has no sense of pace whatsoever. The minute Kathy Moriarty shows up on Belushi's doorstep, she is instantly horny for him, allowing for no tension. If you're going to do this story of the weird neighbors whose behavior can only be accurately sussed out by our protagonist, there has to be at least a ground level. The antagonists must initially behave like actual human beings instead of cartoon characters, only to later reveal themselves as malevolent. There's no concealment of subterfuge here, so nothing can build. As it is, the audience instantly despises Belushi's wife for being unable to accurately gauge the situation and identify Aykroyd and Moriarty as up to no good. There is no way that any reasonable person would be oblivious to their behavior. They are beaming in their sinister nature from outer space when what's required is at least a modicum of nuance.
Defense.
Okay, for my third exhibit, Reels of Justice 104, The People versus What About Bob, Ryan Luis Rodriguez as the defense.
He said that
Bill Murray's character is a cipher in that film, Everyone sees in them what they lack in themselves. Well, that's what Dan Aykroyd and Kathy Moriarty are in this film. It's just a decade earlier. It has to be stacked in Aykroyd's favor. That's why it works. That's why it's effective in setting out what it does. Bill Murray had more nuance and emotional capacity in What About Bob than any of the previous films that he had done. And I think the same could be said for Aykroyd in this film. And in closing on this exhibit here, this one really kind of is the birth of cringe comedy.
Prosecution, any rebuttals there to being thoroughly dunked on?
First of all, I was a defense by contract. I did not do that movie because I cared about it, because I actually do not. In
fact,
you
did a good job.
I disliked the movie, but yes, I did do a very good job. To say that this is the birth of cringe comedy, that discounts a lot of the 1970s. This is the first example, maybe, of bad cringe comedy, but it's certainly not the first example of overall cringe comedy.
You said the claws are out, defense.
You said What About Bob was the first example of cringe comedy during that trial.
And I was lying.
He's a lawyer.
Now that's in contempt of court.
Everyone's in contempt of
can't
this
hold me
court.
In contempt. The statute of limitations is over, my friend.
God, three episodes is the statute of limitations.
That's true. Prosecution, any final points?
Yes, I have one last point. Lastly, I would like to address the score by Bill Conti.
Conti was
not the original composer for the film, and instead came aboard the project when John Avildsen took over the directorial reins, having scored Rocky. And this is one of the reasons that Avildsen should have nothing to do with this film. The score is so goofy that it dulls the impact, with nonstop theremin and tribal drums and slide whistles. Oh, fuck this movie. Black comedy should never play the comedy of the situation. It should pitch the situations therein as something to be taken seriously, which is what fosters the humor. Instead, this is something that wouldn't be out of place on a 70s sitcom, like some kind of Brady Bunch bullshit. To quote Matt Singer from Screen Crush, it's like watching a movie with the worst marching band in the world improvising to what's happening on screen. Most egregiously, Conti frequently quotes the Twilight Zone theme to the point that he most certainly owes Bernard Herrmann a sizable royalty check. The score is also inconsistently incessant. Hardly a minute goes by without the bombast beating you in the face without granting a respite. Then, when the score does cease, it makes the scenes without it seem naked, as if the producers ran over budget and couldn't afford to pay the composer to fill in a few gaps. It is hideous all around. And with that, I rest.
Thank you. Defense, any rebuttals to the accusations hurled against the composer?
While it is one of the most bizarre film scores I've ever heard, I really can't imagine a different score for this film. To me, it highlights the goofiness and the weirdness of the film, the winking eye of the film, the strangeness of the dog being electrocuted and being, it's like, what the hell? And the music fit it perfectly, even though the music sucks. But it did remind me a lot of the score of Cheech and Chong's next movie for some reason. And with that, I'll rest.
You're resting already? That's it? No more points? Do you want to say anything about maybe the visuals? Anything about the sets?
You know, I think it's weird because John Avildsen was the supervising editor on this film, whatever the hell that credit means. And does the guy not like coverage?
I don't know.
Single shots. I mean, you get to see them act off each other, which is always good. But I mean, like the shot where Belushi is in the bathroom putting on every product you can find in the restroom to clean himself up. Half of it is shot from the side angle. And it's like, was there no coverage? I guess that's more of the weird production problems. But that didn't.
Yeah, and don't do the prosecution's job for him. He already did a great job.
If anything, that almost added to the flavor of the film. If it had been shot better, I might not like it as much.
So the flavor of the film is the film sucks? Okay.
I love Inglourious Basterds. It's weird, but it's not bad, but it's not good. It's not guilty of being bad, is all I'm saying.
Well, both sides have rested their cases. The attorneys will now present their closing arguments. Mr. Rodriguez, you may begin.
95 minutes. Neighbors last 95 minutes. 95 interminable minutes. 95 minutes you'll never get back. Of course, all time spent is comprised of minutes you'll never get back. Whether a movie is good or bad, that time is gone. Exchanged for entertainment or punishment. But that doesn't mean that you need to make the sacrifice. There are many other, more valuable things you can do with 95 minutes instead of spending them self-flagellating with a miscast John Belushi. For instance, you could watch Duck Soup 1.5 times. You could huff computer duster with some friends and theorize about the endless void of the cosmos. You could rob a bank and lead a daring police chase. You could write a strongly worded letter to McDonald's demanding that they make the Shamrock Shake a year-round offering. You could abduct a drifter and dissolve his body in an acid tub. All of these things would relieve you of 95 minutes of your time, but they're all more valuable pursuits than spending another second watching Neighbors. It's a garbage movie made by garbage people for garbage people. You don't want to be a garbage person, do you? There's only one just verdict in this trial, and it's up to you and the jury to deliver justice. Thank you. Case dismissed.
Hey, what if I told you about that? Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez. Marty, you may present your closing argument.
Garbage people are very well paid, and they have a great retirement fund, so it's not bad to pick up people's trash for a living, and we shouldn't shame them for that.
That's not our first time.
This is one of those movies like The Cable Guy that if you wait about 3 or 4 years and you watch it again, you're going to see something different in it. I can't make up for that last 10 minutes where the movie completely shifts gears, but you will find different things in it. And, you know, John Belushi only made, what, 6 theatrical films in his time, something like that. You might as well watch all of them. And I like more than 1941. So, and with that, I'll rest.
You already rested.
But
thank you both. Members of the jury, Mr. Rob Maynard, Mr. Dylan J. Schlender, and Mr. Big Ben Haslar, you have all heard the facts concerning this case. It is now up to you to determine if this film is guilty of being a bad movie. The bailiff will escort you to the deliberation room to render your verdict.
Just what in hell was Zac Efron supposed to show? He never did.
The wrong neighbors, bailiff.
No one told him.
Now, Zac Efron, he's the guy that was Shazam?
That's Zachary Levi.
What? Yeah, I know. It was a stupid joke.
Yeah, it is, because I didn't
right,
know
it
Shazam's.
Was stupid.
I didn't know Shazam's name.
All right. Well, good job on Marty. He really brought precedent to this trial, which might prove that the system is broken. Dylan, what did you think?
All right. This is an interesting movie. I had never heard of it before, to be honest with you. And I like Dan Aykroyd quite a bit. And Jim Belushi, rather.
No.
Or is it John Belushi?
John.
John.
Which one's the good Belushi?
John.
So anyway, Belushi, obviously they have the track record doing Blues Brothers, like Ryan brought up. But the movie itself, it's a very bizarre movie. You're watching it, and Maynard and I watched it together. And very soon in the movie, I'm looking at it going, like, man, this soundtrack is just really hammering me. You know, it's like, it's hard to.
Yeah. It's the Twilight Zone, right? That's the first hit where you're just like, that's the Twilight Zone. What's going on?
And it kind of keeps going and keeps going. And then they do the bit where they shut the TV off and the music stops. And we're like, oh, okay. But then it immediately starts up again. And we're like, what the hell? So,
It seemed they were doing it over the top for that gag.
Yeah.
And it was very distracting initially. Then it seemed to work, get the payoff with that gag. Then they just kept going with it, which is like, I mean, technically the TV got turned back on again, but like it wasn't funny.
No.
What, you want me to write another song?
No, and so Ryan brought up a great point on that point, so I'm very glad he brought a whole point up for that, because I agree 100%. And then the idea is, like, there's no time for tension to build. I mean, this movie starts off right at 60 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour. The point is, it's at the same speed the whole time. And you don't really let anything build up because it's just like, just stop dealing with these people. You know, just go to bed and go to work tomorrow. It was hard, almost any time.
The whole situation could be resolved by saying, I'm sorry, this is all a little much, you know?
Yeah, it's like, well, good night.
Like, you just getting naked in my bed, I'm sorry, you know, like, instead of this whole humming-a-humming-a-humming-a stuff he does, like, just,
yeah, that was,
get out.
It was a little weird. Well, I felt like there was
he doesn't want to kick Moriarty out of his bed.
It does feel like there were... Like some scenes missing. It just felt like there were gaps in this movie. But, you know, Maynard, give us your thoughts here. What were you thinking?
I agree that it's not paced out well. It does go right into it. We don't get to see the neighbors as anything normal in the beginning. But I think worse than that is we don't really get to see how humdrum Belushi's life is at the beginning. And that kind of turns out to be the payoff in the ending is that, you know, we found out Belushi's unhappy in his situation, right? And that's the whole catalyst for why he ends up accepting these neighbors as his friends, is that seemingly he was bored with his innocuous life. But then that begs the question of why he wanted them to leave in the first place. The whole movie, why did he want to return to a life he felt was innocuous?
A very strange way they tried to develop and shift his character like that. You know, it was like just a weird
twist for twist's sake.
Yeah, where he's like, you know what? This is actually the most fun I've ever had. Was this really a book? Who read the book for this show?
I didn't, but Brian probably did.
But
no, it had a different ending. I don't know what that ending was, but I know that they changed it.
See, I don't mind the ending. I just wish the beginning and middle had paid it off. It had set it up.
Whole movie was the ending.
I never felt the movie was boring, though, because I never knew what would happen next, because most of it was illogical and not based on any character's development or choices. I can't even really say that any characters were really developed, besides the fact that Aykroyd seems to be, like, compulsively dishonest.
Yeah, I mean, if you took the daughter out of the movie, nothing would change.
Right, if you take any of it. Dan Aykroyd, he picks up a book that has a swastika on it, and, you know, he's got blonde hair and blue eyes, yet John Belushi has this book in his house. Like, what is going on there? It wasn't brought up in the trial, but it just bugs me. What was going on?
Yeah, I said something about it, too, when I was watching the movie, and, I mean, obviously, Belushi just had a history book lying around that had the swastika on it, so I'm sure it's just a history of the Nazis or anything. But, yeah, Dan Aykroyd's blonde hair, blue-eyed, and he has, like, a Red Baron remote control plane. There's clearly some sort of subplot here about him being a Nazi sympathizer
Aggressor. I was wondering if he's, like, being a Nazi aggressor, like, into Poland or something.
That's interesting.
That's an interesting take. I feel like it's a scene that was lost. You know, there feels like there was a lot of gaps in this movie, and that was maybe something they were trying to set up because he loved Germany.
I liked is I liked that the two houses, you know, their windows can look like eyes. That right, and Belushi's house is like his eyes are darted over, watching the neighbor. Yeah, but it's like a goofy, silly eye, like a side eye. And it's completely intentional. It's very obvious when you look at it. And I thought that was a fun, small detail. I don't mind the character switch so much. I think it benefits Aykroyd way more. I think Aykroyd was more believable in his role. Belushi wasn't very believable as a straight man suburbanite.
Yeah, or they just had to make him like schlubbier or something. Like, I don't know. I feel like they couldn't get the balance right with him. But, you know, we've been talking about a lot what we didn't like about the movie. But looking at the case, I really like that Marty brought up precedent here in the court referencing. Because those were good points, too. You know, like the web about Bob, talking about Bob being a cipher. You know, Dan Aykroyd is a cipher. It's like, okay, these are all interesting points. The expectation argument about the cable guy versus this, that one strikes me as a little more on the thin side, but I do appreciate it all.
Really, I think that's the one that's more on the nose. Like,
you think that
whether
on the
or
nose?
Not
the expectations?
Whether or not Carrie works in the cable guy going against expectation is up for debate. I kind of didn't think he did. But still, there's something to be said for going for something, which I could commend this movie for going for something. As far as the cipher, we never really see what Belushi is missing. So I can't see how we're supposed to appreciate what how Aykroyd represents it.
Well, it's supposed to be that adventure, that freedom and everything. That's what all
we never see end. That he's miserable, really.
No, and not until the end. That's the whole point.
So yeah, not until they just make it up and pull it out of their ass.
Surprise, he was unhappy. I would have liked to see the movie again, set it up, like I said earlier.
Yeah, like I said, there's big scenes missing. That's the only explanation I have.
But you sound like you've got your mind made up. Which way are you going?
Me? The D-Man? I'm going guilty.
Lay it on us, D-Man.
I'm sorry to say. Ryan just brought a very, very good case. Marty brought up some very good points that are worth considering. But at the end of the day, this is a bad movie. It is just poorly executed. It is poorly realized. There's just not a lot of meat on that bone. You know, I think people probably should see it. Like you said, there's only so many Belushi movies, right? But yeah, it's... Oof, no. So I'm
you punch four on that card. Go for the six. Come on.
Yeah.
Get your free sub.
As for me... I liked, like, I had fun in this movie. I liked it because it was so wildly unpredictable. And I like the performers. I liked them seeing them play against type, even if it didn't work. And I also thought Marty did do such a good job of researching prior cases to bring up precedent that, you know, I'd like to give a punch to his card. So I'm going to go not guilty.
I respect that.
And then there was one. Gosh, this movie is just so odd. At no point was I getting what I think that they wanted from me. I was never really laughing. Like his contact lenses. I had the same problem with Hawkeye, you know, like with her. I'm looking at her eyes and I'm thinking not her real eye color, not her real eye color, not her real eye color throughout the whole thing. This film definitely had that. Aykroyd did not look like a person through this film. Everything like they, every expectation they had, like every scene was just stapled together with no connection between what happened before and what's going to happen after. Like Belushi has like this set of valuable jars and he just like introduces it for a second before it's destroyed. You know, like what was the point of this? Aykroyd is thrown into like a mud pit and then somehow he makes it out of this quicksand and is in his shower. You know, that's never really explained why, just because, well, we got to move on to our next gag. I do adore Marty for having so much precedent, though. I don't think anyone could have made me vote not guilty on this film, but bless him, he has come as close as any man has. But unfortunately, I do have to go guilty.
All right.
Devastating. Well, then we should go out there and tell that very handsome judge.
All righty.
Mr. Foreman, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor. In the case of the People versus Neighbors, we find the film guilty.
Well, the verdict is so rendered. I hereby sentence 1981's Neighbors to continue to languish in the cinematic obscurity of the movie suburbs, where it will live out each day of the rest of its life just like the last, feeling no highs and no lows until it finally perishes, uncelebrated and unremembered. Court is adjourned.
This is Tom Brokaw reporting to you live from outside the Reels of Justice. Mr. Ryan Luis Rodriguez, would you care to share your thoughts on the jury's verdict?
I won! Fuck this movie.
And just look how happy he is. All right, here comes Marty Cotola. Excuse me, could we get a word from you about how you feel about today's verdict?
They say justice was served, but, you know, we'll see when it comes time to try the burbs.
Oh, God.
No. No.
God, no. No.
Oh, I like the idea now that I heard how much Ryan doesn't.
Should have been a head-to-head.
Well, thank you very much. This is all we have from the courthouse today. I'm Tom Brokaw. Let's go back to the studio for a post-trial analysis.
I like that Tom Brokaw had to tell you who he was twice.
Yeah.
He does that, dude. That's what he does. That's a, get out of here, Tom Brokaw. It was good seeing you. Man, no one ever suspect that was someone doing a voice. Oh, my
good job, Marty. Good job.
Yeah, good, and good job, Marty. And also, thank you, Marty, because I hadn't seen this movie. And I'm glad I did.
So you got to punch that card off now, right? You're complete on your John Belushi.
I could see watching it again. I could just see if I was in that itch for a weird Belushi Aykroyd movie. I'd already watched Blues Brothers, and I wanted some more. I could see putting this one on just because it's so strange. Right. But I thought, actually, you brought up a point that I was thinking of there, Ben, where you're talking about the whole Nazi character. And I wonder if you know, the blonde hair, the blue eyes...
The German Shepherd
was left over from, like, when Aykroyd would have been the straight man, you know, and maybe he would have had the book on his shelf and kind of been lightly fascinated with the Third Reich. And they just, even though they decided to swap, they decided to keep that idea in.
That doesn't explain the plane, though.
Let's get Dan Aykroyd on this podcast. We need to ask him. He could have questions that need answering.
He could have been flying the plane. You know, anyway.
So he would have had the plane too. Like, yeah, that would have been his hobby out there in the suburbs, flying around the model plane.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe Belushi borrows the plane, burns down his own house, or Belushi burns down his house. A lot of stuff that could have been left over and maybe just swapped around. Anyway, Marty, what were your thoughts?
And what is real in the movie? I've read some interpretations that think it's all Earl's hallucination.
I don't know if I.
Why is he hallucinating? Slipping drugs.
It goes it's like a surrealist abstract movie in that respect. That's why things don't make any sense, why the daughter has hair is one way and then different. In reality, it's a bunch of production problems, but you can interpret it as, you know, a dream.
So you're acknowledging it's a bad movie, but if you interpret it a certain way, then it's okay.
All those MST films, you know, they're terrible, but we love them.
Because someone's sitting because there making fun of them at the same time.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a bad movie, but I had fun with it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I don't hate it. You know, I do think people should.
I do.
Should watch
I
do. It.
I do.
I didn't hate it.
I didn't hate it. I despise it. I don't know if I would watch it again, though.
It's just so rare. Like, Belushi stuff is forgettable. You so rarely get to see Aykroyd do that kind of stuff that I thought it was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Aykroyd burn more so than Saving Grace.
Want to burn it all down.
Anyway, Marty, we're glad to have you back. What have you been busy with since we saw you last?
I've been finishing up my latest film. We managed to finish the shooting of it in June, and it's in post-production right now. It's the follow-up to my previous film, which was called Revenge of Zoe. This one's called The Love Song of William H. Shaw, and it should be out of post-production in February or March and hitting film festivals around spring or summer of this year.
Oh, cool.
Very exciting.
I'm sure we'll get a DVD copy as a screener beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And bribes. We also accept bribes.
That's true. We're in Vegas.
So this was
Sundance.
Shot and planned like all through the pandemic?
Well, we started shooting in March of 2020. What a great month to start. And
I got a good feel about this one.
He's in, and then we had to shut down. And then last year there was a small patch in the summer where the numbers were kind of low, and we managed to get back together for a few days and shoot everything that was left to be shot, and nobody got sick, so that's good.
Now, Marty, what everyone wants to know, is this just going to complete the trilogy of these films that you've done, or is there a fourth one possibly on the way?
Quadrilogy.
I would say this wraps up the trilogy. I'm currently working on a couple of new screenplays that are, you know, fresh ideas, doing something a little different. Been living with these characters for a while, and while as I enjoy them, it's time to do something different.
Are they going to be dancing around in your head, though, when you do drugs, like in the movie?
don't they do that to you?
Oh, of course.
On the rare occasions that Dylan does drugs, yes. Hey, but you could always do a Big Kahuna Burger kind of thing. Any future characters you have could always be reading Revenge of Zoe or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it could all be like one universe.
Yeah, exactly. The Cthulhuverse.
The Cthulhuverse.
Restore the Cthulhuverse. Hashtag.
Patent pending. I own that now.
We're getting that trending now.
you say festivals in the spring. When do you foresee it coming to streaming platforms?
Hopefully by summer or maybe fall, depending on how long it takes for a distributor to pick us up. We think that the previous distributor might be interested in this one, and if so, then they can just pick it up and hopefully get this new one on Tubi as well. So,
excellent, excellent. So we'll have to have you back around
that and time. Revenge of Zoe is still on Tubi, correct, right now? If people want to.
Yeah, so give it a look.
There you go. Yeah, so go check them out.
Is the first one, I can't remember the first one. So is that one on Tubi?
Oh, the first one was called Writing Frenzy, and that one's from 2009, but I've never had an actual distribution deal for that one. We're hoping that after the third one comes out, that they'll want the first one so they can have the entire trilogy on their streaming service.
Yeah, exactly.
If not, we'll release it ourselves on Amazon or something.
It's like, I don't know, what movie where the first one they released was a part two, and everyone started hunting for the part one.
It was Star Wars. It was the fourth one came out first.
Star Wars. No, it wasn't.
Is it The Lost Kingdom 2?
Oh, like Desperado or something? Or
I can't remember anymore.
No, I can't think of the name of it. It wasn't Desperado.
But I know it was a marketing ploy, and it was a brilliant one. But yeah, we look forward to that, and we'll check that out. The Love Song of Herbert Shaw, is that right?
William H. Shaw.
William H. Shaw. I got stuck on the H. I was like, Herbert.
Maybe that's
William H. Shaw. All right. See, that's why you should have said the title. So we always ask our guests for a recommendation of a film that you think people should see. So besides your own, people have to wait. What is another movie that you think people should check out?
Well, in keeping with the theme, I'm going to recommend 2009's A Serious Man. It's a Coen Brothers film. It's about a straight-laced guy from the 50s who does not want what the 60s has in store for him, but he's getting it no matter if he likes it or not. I thought it was an excellent film, one of the Coen Brothers' best.
Very ominous. Have you seen this one, Ryan? Have you heard
of this?
Yes,
I have. I've seen all the Coen Brothers' movies. Good stuff.
Okay. I don't know. It sounds like a biopic for Dylan.
Hey. Oh.
Serious Man. But no, let's check it out. I'll always check out a Coen Brothers picture.
Oh, they always do good work. I mean, you know that's probably going to be a home run.
Yeah. Good guys. You got to keep your eyes out for them.
Yeah, they're going places.
Yeah, promising young stars. So, Ryan, you were our other juror, so what is your recommendation?
Last time we did a Dan Aykroyd movie, I recommended The Blues Brothers, so I can't do that again.
That was like last week.
And I recommended it first.
So instead, I will pivot and pick something completely unrelated, something that hasn't left my brain since I saw it, and that's The Matrix Resurrections.
Ooh.
Now, I have my misgivings about the film, namely the way that it looks and the way that the action is shot, but it is a great imaginative sequel about the lack of purpose and imagination in sequels. It's a meta commentary on the state of the entertainment industry in the age of reboots and IP and blockbusters made by committee. And it's a film, most importantly, that refuses to deliver anything you're expecting in a new Matrix movie to great effect. I don't know if it will be streaming on HBO Max by the time this episode drops, but it will be back there eventually.
No wonder the fanboys hate it so much.
Yes. I 100% agree
with
you, though.
That's why I like it.
Especially with like
the
Ghostbusters film and Spider-Man. And then that came out. Like, that was a meta sequel, kind of like for people who are like tired of this like fan pleasiness of the previous ones, like those previous franchise sequels. Yeah, I liked it. It seems like everyone's not on our page, though.
Hey, Maynard, you were the judgman of this court thingy.
Judster.
What's your Judster? That's it. What's your recommendation?
Thank you. For this week's recommendation, I'm going to break one of the most important rules of the courtroom and commit reducto ad Shyamalan.
Oh.
And recommend 2021's Old.
Oh, why?
I am always impressed with M. Night Shyamalan's ability to ham-fistedly cram exposition into every single line of his dialogue, and the way he pulls the most confusing choices out of his performers is really a marvel. That said, this movie is so much fun simply because of how batshit out of its mind the premise is, a beach that gradually makes everyone age 2 years for every hour spent on it. Are the nuances of how subtle aging can be taken into any consideration? Of course not. Does the film deal with how the characters of young children suddenly emotionally and mentally mature well past their lived experiences? Not a fucking chance. Does it take advantage of every opportunity to do something outrageous and unexpected simply for the sake of being outrageous and unexpected? You bet your sweet patoot it does. If Milquetoast reviews have dissuaded you from seeing this one, ignore them, because this movie is one senseless, bizarre choice after another that will leave you laughing one moment and then saying, what? No! The next.
Yep, no, that's true.
I like
old,
it.
Old is currently... See? And Ryan liked it. And that's what's most important. I liked it too. That's why I'm recommending it. Old is currently available for rent or purchase through whatever normal mediums you do that sort of thing at.
You know,
what'd you like about
it,
Ryan?
I kind of liked it too.
Well, I like the fact that it's not about aging. It's about being a parent. And that's something that strings itself through a lot of Shyamalan's best movies. And
like Lady in the Water.
Yeah, exactly.
What?
But it's like, no, but it is. It's ingenious in the way that it does exactly what you expect it to do and does exactly what you don't expect it to do at the same time, which is a really hard thing to pull off. But I think that it's of his recent stuff, it's easily my favorite.
Yeah, I mean, I had a good time with it. I wouldn't say I liked it more than Split.
I did.
But it's the best thing I've liked since Split, at least. So better than
I'd say best since The Visit.
I liked it, but the ending was a bit stretched.
Oh, the ending
sucks.
The ending
totally
sucks.
Oh, okay, good. I was just like, okay, we get it. Let's just end the movie, Shyamalan. Come on.
Yeah, he should have ended it 15 minutes early.
Oh, no, it was fun. Mayor and I had a blast watching it, just like hooting and hollering at it. And
yeah.
I do really like, his name escapes me, but the leading man in there, the little guy, he was also in Mozart in the Jungle, and he does one of the voices in Coco. He's great in everything. I like him quite a bit. Now, I don't like him enough to learn his name, but I do like him.
Apparently. But yeah, no. So see, a lot of praise for Old. So, Big Ben, what is your recommendation?
I'm going to go with another film, where someone moves in and makes the protagonist's life hell, and go with Pacific Heights, which is where a couple accidentally rent out a room to a scam artist who is played by Michael Keaton. And while, yes, a lot of the problems that the couple face are made worse by their own impulsive stupidity, I find this film fun to watch because it's one of those that show Michael Keaton can be just as likable as he can be terrifying. And no film is made worse by Mr. Mom. It's rentable pretty much everywhere. I don't think it's streamable by main apps.
Is Michael Keaton usually terrifying?
Is he?
He's terrifying in this one.
You've seen Beetlejuice. Of course he is.
Yeah.
Okay. I always thought he was sort of fun.
He was like,
but...
didn't he play like a bird monster in a movie too? He was the Birdman?
Yeah, it's Harvey Birdman the movie, I believe.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
And the Vulture.
No.
He played two bird villains. He was the Vulture.
It might have that other guy in it whose name I can't remember.
I think isn't Matthew Modine, isn't he the guy? And Melanie Griffith, I think.
Cool,
Melanie
Modine.
Griffith. Yeah, I didn't know the other guy.
Cool Modine.
Just some guy.
DJS, send us on home.
All right. Well, as gratified as I am that Marty actually listens to our podcast and he was able to prove it by citing all this precedent, I am going to prove my love for a similar podcast, The Coolness Chronicles with Ryan Luis Rodriguez, who, if you go back a couple weeks, did a fantastic episode all about the Naked Gun series, but I can only recommend one movie, so I'm going to recommend the first one, The Naked Gun from the Files of Police Squad, which came out in 1988, directed by David Zucker, starring Leslie Nielsen, and this just might be one of the funniest movies you've ever seen in your life. O.J. Simpson's in it too, which is actually kind of funny in its own way. But it's just a hilarious movie with tons of great comedic decisions. It's over the top, but like there's still good action. There's a neat story to it. It's got a little bit of everything, and you probably won't laugh harder. Another movie we recommended today.
Voted by the New York Times as one of the 1,000 best movies ever made.
Which true you fact. Said went a little too far, but
I
say
do,
it doesn't
I
go
think
too
that
far
goes
enough.
A little too far, but still, I mean, that's got to stand for something, right?
Would you call it a top 100 comedy?
I think I would. Yeah.
Well, then I think it deserves to be on the top 1,000.
It could be
in
the top 1,000.
Top 1,000 movies of all time.
Yes, yes, the top 1,000 movies. I think we deserve to put comedies in there if they're executed well.
We do, but the, I mean, like putting Airplane in Top Secret, okay, that's fine. But Naked Gun, top 1,000 movies ever made? No, that's okay.
I don't know. Maybe I would have to see the other 999 to be honest with you.
You could see them on Ryan's Letterbox.
On Ryan's Letterbox,
he watched them last month. excellent, Marty. What do you think? Naked Gun should be in the top 1,000 movies.
I mean, it's a really funny movie. I've always enjoyed it. I mean, yeah, sure, it should be in the top 1,000. I mean. Such a huge list. I mean, I can't think of, you know, 999 other movies off the top of my head.
Well, no,
can't think of another 1,000 movies.
Well, here's the thing, too. When you start looking at, like, 1,000 movies, like, is 960 really that much worse than 942? You know, it's like, what becomes the demarcation?
I don't know. It's probably pretty arbitrary in there somewhere.
I would hope so. Pretty arbitrary was my name nickname in college.
Does O.J. Simpson deserve to be on the top 1,000 actors?
Oh, totally.
Yes, 1,000%. But only for Naked Gun 33 and a third, not the first Naked Gun.
Yeah, with the afro. That killer afro. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Whoa, Ryan, don't say killer afro.
Oh, Jesus. We'll cut that. Or not.
We did not. Never okay, happened.
It did not. We did not do that. Okay.
All right. Well, pretty cool. Then I guess with that, it's all the time we have. But we want to thank our guest, Marty Cotola, for joining us. Thank you so much, Marty.
Yes, thank you. It's an honor to be back on. I feel privileged to have gone up against the great Ryan Luis Rodriguez. I listen to his podcast all the time, so it's a little nervous when I'm hearing like, oh shit, I'm going up against Ryan. This is crazy.
I knew. No, I purposely didn't tell you because I knew you'd crap your pants once you saw he was on.
That's why I haven't gone against him yet in our own heads.
Ryan is hard to take on. He is hard to take on. I've only been able to best him the one time.
It's the only time you tried, I think.
It's true. We'll I'm retiring undefeated.
A rematch. And I'm sure you'll go down the next time. And we will all be on the lookout this summer / fall for The Love Song of William H. Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
The H, I'm pretty sure, stands for Herbert, I've heard.
Is
it Herbert, or did I make that up?
Both. Yeah, who knows? Maybe you've had canon.
You don't know what the H stands for, Marty! But thank you, Marty, and you're always welcome back. We'll have you back as soon as we can to lose to Ryan again.
And, no, you come back and you beat me. You know I'm the guy who loses here, so that's what you got to do.
And with that, we hope everyone else will join us again as well as the reels of justice keep turning.
Count it.
OJ.
Oh, no. Is that Ryan? No.
Please follow us on Twitter at Reels of Justice, Instagram Reels of Justice, and Facebook.com/Reels of Justice.